Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back to Your Cases on Hold, episode 22, covering the November 16th issue of JBJS. As always, we are covering the best that this journal has to offer, and all the highlights will be covered in this episode. Remember to like and subscribe, give us a five-star rating, and find us on jbjs.org, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or any of the places where you find your podcasts. Per the usual, our comments are ours alone and not those of the Board of Trustees, the Editor-in-Chief, or the Editorial Board of JBJS or the other constituent journals. I am Dr. Chim Richards, MD, professional doctor. Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods, is on vacation.
Oh, my brain's on vacation too, so that's too bad. But in her place is Dr. Antonia Chen, who is the Adult Reconstruction Deputy Editor.
You don't remember coming to see me? I'm a professional doctor.
So are many professional doctors.
So here we go, talking about the top of the pile. What's new in orthopedic rehabilitation from Castanon et al., which is permanently free. There are then also three evidence-based orthopedic articles where we have individuals who are experts from the JBJS space covering articles that are published in other journals. Very interesting, very insightful, so check those out. From the Arts and Humanities desk, we have Landscapes of North Carolina by Shields. And then we have an interesting historical perspective, Organizing Orthopedic Societies in New York City in the 1880s. The New York Orthopedic Society, the New York Academy of Medicine Section of Orthopedic Surgery, and the American Orthopedic Association by Ticker and colleagues. You know, one of my undergraduate degrees is in history.
One of many, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I have several. A professional student right here. Early career sports medicine surgeons perform a large volume of non-sports medicine procedures, ABOS Step 2 data regarding orthopedic surgeons specializing in sports medicine by Inclon and colleagues.
I'd like to see that in other subspecialties as well. I'd be curious because I think traumas are workhorse when we're starting out.
Yeah, definitely. There have been a lot that have come out of the ABOS data collection that they do on orthopedic surgeons, both in JBJS and in other settings. So there's a research idea that has come to you free of charge.
You're welcome.
We're going to move into the headlines now. We'll start with my headline, The Effect of Social Deprivation on Fracture Healing and Patient-Reported Outcomes Following Intramedullary Nailing of Tibial Shaft Fractures. This is by Zachary Hong and colleagues. There is a commentary and it's also 30-day free. So you don't only just not have to take my word for it, but you can also read what others are thinking about it and definitely check it out for yourself no matter what. In the print issue on jbjs.org or just off of Ovid, again, with the 30-day free access. So this was a very interesting study talking about the area deprivation index as a way to evaluate social deprivation and its impact specifically on fracture healing and patient-reported outcomes in intramedullary narrowing of tibial shaft fractures. So a little bit niche, to be honest. And initially, right off the bat, I'm saying, you know, why did you just look at intramedullary nails? Like there's, you know, so many other aspects of orthopedic trauma surgery that have the same kind of overlap with issues with fracture healing and patient-reported outcomes that are, of course, vitally important across the board. But what they did was they looked at 229 patients who underwent intramedullary nailing at their center, which is a level one trauma center in St. Louis. And they looked at these impacts across a tertiles of the area deprivation index. So they have the least deprived, intermediate, and then the most deprived. Now, based on where they were located, they actually only had 20 patients in the least deprived tertile. And if you look at their table one, there's a lot of imbalance across the cohorts. I think this also really impacted their ability to do a robust statistical analysis. And a lot of what they're speaking about is what they call univariate, but is conventionally bivariate comparisons. Their ultimate conclusions were that social deprivation is associated with slower fracture healing and potentially influences short-term patient-reported outcomes. They endorse the need for further research into the underlying drivers of these mechanisms. I think this is a very interesting study that does bring to light the importance of social deprivation and talks about the area deprivation index. And these are definitely important areas for the readership to be familiar with and those who are interested in doing research in this space to understand to a greater degree. I think when you really get down to it, though, while the concepts are great and there's the discussion is very rich with important points and that can help you get up to speed on social deprivation and the area deprivation index, when we're talking about the actual substrate, there are a lot of limitations. And that just results from issues with the sample. In a perfect world, if you said, well, how would I do this? I would have expanded it to other aspects of orthopedic trauma surgery that have the same areas of concern, such as fracture healing, patient-reported outcomes, and then you could adjust for the type of fracture or the type of treatment in your analyses. Basically, they need more patients in the low deprivation tertile because they only have 20, and that really restricts both your power and then creates opportunities for confounding from restricted clinical variation and truncation. If you look at the reoperation percentages, it's 29% in the most deprived tertile, 17% in the intermediate, and then 40% in the low, but that's only 8 patients. And they didn't have the power to really even detect a over 10 percentage point difference between the most deprived tertile and the least deprived tertile. So these are real concerns from a methodology standpoint. They were appropriately upfront about it. They have actually 2 paragraphs of limitations. So when you're talking about you've found 2 paragraphs of issues associated with the work, I think at the end of the day, you have to take it where you have to meet them where they are, essentially. They used log linear analyses, which are really tough to interpret. But you can look, again, this is table 4 in their ADI tertiles. There's not a lot of signal there. They have wide confidence intervals. The difference between the least and the intermediate is not significant. It is significant for the most. But again, there's some concerns with both sample and signal. And I think they really are underpowered to detect secondary effects and interactions. And that's evident in their table 5, again, with the comparisons across the ADI tertiles. So I think on the one hand, a nice work that brings to light an understudied area in orthopedics and is kind of a starting point for the conversation. In terms of clinical applicability or how this would translate to other centers, I think that those questions are really left unanswered.
The good news is this ADI is a nice harbinger for what we're going to discuss later. We're going to bring that in again for another one.
Foreshadowing, I think they call that.
Yes, that's a much better word.
Arts and humanities. Again, it's not just in the opening segment. It's baked in throughout.
I'm a boring bio major, so I can't say anything there.
I would have been a theater major. I would have. I know this comes as a surprise to everyone.
This is your acting now.
Right, that's right. I'm a frustrated actor. I was Macbeth, and I was good.
And what was your favorite scene?
Macbeth? Oh, in Macbeth? I don't know. Probably like the soliloquy. Is this a dagger that I see before me, the handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. Don't get me started. I was Dracula, too. And I was good.
Too bad Halloween episode's already over.
That's right.
Sorry.
We did Dracula.
All right. Very good. I agree. It'd be nice to see this in other fields as well, too. But I'm going to switch a little bit and go another trauma one, but high rates of imminent subsequent fracture after femoral neck fracture in the elderly by Baruch et al. And there's also an infographic on this one.
And Dr. Swinkowski is one of the co-authors. And so is Dr. Bhandari. So tread carefully.
This is the perfect article. I'm done. We all know fragility fractures are obviously a really big problem. And as my co-host has well pointed out, these are big studies that have been done, Dr. Bhandari being obviously the king of multiple studies that are, you know, prospective, some randomized, and really changed the landscape of orthopedic surgery. And there are two studies that this one was incorporated from, the FACE study and the HEALTH study. And they were both specifically looking at femoral neck fractures in their analysis. Now, some were treated by sliding hip screw versus three screws versus arthroplasty. So there's two different treatment regimens, but same patient populations with regards to femoral neck fractures specifically. And the premise was, understandably, a lot of times they just say, well, a patient sustained a hip fracture. And after that, how many other fractures did they sustain? And of course, we know that one fracture, unfortunately, is a harbinger for another fracture, right? Whether it be another hip fracture, whether it be, you know, distal radius fractures, vertebral fractures, et cetera, et cetera. But they wanted to tease up whether or not femoral neck fracture specifically has a higher risk of other fractures. And it would have been really nice in the study to compare femoral neck fractures versus inner troch fractures or other proximal femur fractures. But these studies that they reference from do not have these patient databases there. So in the future, another nugget for those who are conducting research, if you have inner troch fractures, it would be a good comparison group. But looking specifically at this femoral neck fracture group, they found that there were 282 secondary fractures, so a 9% fracture rate. And the most common location was probably not surprising as the contralateral hip. So total population, 4.5%. And then proximal humerus, vertebral, pelvis, and rib fractures. And understandably, most of these were women. It was actually 77% of women were the ones who sustained these fractures. And interestingly enough, the mean interval of time to fracture was 9 and 9.5 months. So the million-dollar question is, would an intervention at the time of the first fracture actually make a difference with regards to preventing the second fracture? And that's what endocrinologists are good for. And they're way better at this than we are in determining on what's the next step and are these steps appropriate? One thing they did find is that looked at patients and they said all the patients supposedly got vitamin D and calcium, but they don't know if they had some sort of other medication, something like bone growth medication. And these are, you know, medications that we use for osteoporosis, things like lendronate, and there's a whole bunch of
paraparotide, abaloparotide.
We can just keep going the alliteration.
Yeah, Prolia, all the time. Right. Keep going.
So this is what orthopedic surgeons aren't good at, but we're really good at referring people.
I know the names people, anyway.
Right? I mean, that's half the battle. Right. Like, so that's the part here. So the good news is that some people were referred to it. The bad news is only 25% of patients were actually referred to some sort of bone protective medication between the index fracture and final follow-up at 2 years. And that's not much at all. The interesting factors are females, those with non-displaced fractures, and those treated with arthroplasty were more likely to get these bone protective medications, which just percentage-wise makes sense, right? There's 77% women who are getting these fractures, and most people who are sustaining these fractures are women. So because of that, they're more likely to be referred to these programs. The one that says non-displaced fractures, the author said, we don't know really why, or arthroplasty, whether or not it's protecting their arthroplasty from becoming a periprosthetic fracture, because the revision from that is much harder. That could be part of the factor as well. But that's one of the areas that they said that that women had these risks. One thing I would have loved to see is to see how many people were still taking the vitamin D and calcium, and if that had an impact on whether or not they had a subsequent fracture. And I also would, again, like to see the comparison between femoral neck fractures and other types of fractures. We did find that those who were in the HEALTH study, which is the arthroplasty cohort, had a higher rate of subsequent fractures. So whether or not arthroplasty predisposed to them, or the patients were, you know, sicker, or fractures were more displaced, so it was hard to tell. So it'd be nice if we would tease down potentially into fracture patterns, you know, Garden classification, you know, non-displaced, displaced, and do a little more subsequent analysis in those areas to really understand, and potentially say, hey, look, if you have a displaced femoral neck fracture, you should ideally treat it in this manner and get them on this medication. So something more prescriptive would probably be helpful to those who are reading this article from an application standpoint. But it's really nice to see these big databases being utilized in different ways and subsequent getting analysis out of them that could potentially say, okay, now you got to be really careful. You know, these patients, not only 9% progress to another fracture, but this within 1 year, right? In 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, will that number go up? And likely yes. So, and we're not doing a really good job of referring these to our endocrinologist colleagues or things to get those on those tides and other medications.
Yeah, no. And the other thing that really stood out to me that I was thinking about is that these are the FAITH and HEALTH investigator sites. So if you take a look at what sites are participating, it's a who's who of academic centers and individuals who are plugged in and really, I think, passingly aware of these kinds of things, possibly to a greater degree than even in the community, although I don't know that for a fact. And I admit that that is my own bias. But these centers may actually be the leaders in getting patients on these medications, and they're not getting the right. So then how is it in the places that aren't participating in these centers, that aren't at academic institutions, where it really is For us at our center, not difficult to plug someone in with the women's bone health clinic or the endocrinology clinic. It's not necessarily that way, where you don't have a ready nexus or intersection with the endocrinology team. Although nowadays with the electronic medical record, it seems like you can send a message to anybody. So something to be aware of, and really important points. I thought this was an incredibly thoughtful study and, not surprising. And I'm also not just saying that because Mark Swinkowski is our boss and lets us do this podcast.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. Shout out to Mark.
So keeps it interesting. I like that. I'm actually curious what our percentage of patients who've been sustained hip fractures actually get these bone preserving medications. Yeah. So
no,
we might be bad too.
Well, we are a center that contributes to.
I know. So we're not 25.
Yeah, we're
whether or not we're lower or higher, and someone made up for us, that's the hard part.
Like Rangu, it's in there.
I love it. All right, next one.
All right, your case is on hold. Here we go. The impact of surgeon variability on patient-reported outcome measures, length of stay, discharge disposition, and 90-day readmission in total knee arthroplasty by Sinclair and colleagues. There is a visual summary for our visual learners. I will preface this by saying, I think this is the most controversial paper we have covered yet in 22 episodes.
Yes.
And not only in 22 episodes, but within recent memory of what's been at the journal. And I think it's very controversial, not for what they say in the end, but what people can take away from this investigation. I think there's a lot of kind of red lines that they're sort of tiptoeing on, I guess you could say. And we've talked about Kaiser Soze papers in the past, and it's always been around the ABOS or the OITE. It's like a study that you're just like, yeah, no big deal. And then there's, you know, hundreds of questions on it. I think this is a different kind of, I'm going to have to come up with like a different name. This is like a Kaiser Soze study because it's like the administrators and regulatory people could latch onto this and unleash a whole firestorm. So I'm surprised on many levels, and we'll touch on some of those as we dissect this. But this was a study out of a single healthcare system, the Cleveland Clinic system, looking at 36 surgeons between 2016 and 2018 doing total knees. They have 5,400 patients. And they looked at a variety of outcome, including the Coos, the Coos Jr., which again is like the Coos after Coos was captured by Mario, then Coos Jr. comes and rescues the big Coos, right? The patient acceptable symptom state, length of stay, discharge disposition, 90-day readmission. So patient-centered outcomes, and then, you know, kind of this rubric battery of quality measures. And they found that the surgeon variable, so who the surgeon was, contributed more to the one-year outcome. Again, who the surgeon is, who is the person that you're having surgery with, contributes more to the one-year outcome than factors like BMI, Charlson comorbidity index, and the difference between the highest and lowest median probabilities of attaining the same value for Coos pain, Coos Jr., length of stay, discharge disposition, and readmission were all moderate. That at the lowest was 6%. And this is the derivative that's coming from who the surgeon is. And so the first thing is that, oh, this is volume driven. But they say that this is not the driver of surgeon level variation. They say it's not volume based. And that's like the conventional default, is that this would be volume based. And then, and this is where it really gets interesting. So they find all of this, they do all this work, and they find these meaningful variations in across 36 surgeons, and that the surgeon is the driver of the outcome. The conclusion is Surgeon variability should be considered when model fitting in the setting of total knee arthroplasty. That's so interesting. That's so interesting to me, because when a patient says, I didn't have a good outcome, you don't tell them, oh, well, if we just account for, you know, who your surgeon was and your other factors, then you did have a good outcome. To couch this as like some kind of academic exercise where at the end of the day, it's like our conclusion is that you should actually account for who's doing the surgeon when measuring outcomes. Well, I mean, for lack of a better thing, no kidding. Like
supplies.
You always want to account for everything that you can possibly account for in any kind of analysis, because you're trying to get close to that epistemological truth that we've talked about in the Plato's cave analogy. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go back to like episode 4 and episode 3, and we go into that in full detail. So it's worth your while to check that out. But ultimately, we're trying to get the absolute truth here, right? So of course, surgeon variation is going to be contributing to it. The prominent finding is that it contributes so much, so meaningfully. And I think that the first conclusion that one would draw is, okay, well, if it's the surgeon that's driving the outcome, you need to get all the patients to the best performing surgeons. I think the conceit, if you will, that all of medicine, not just surgery, but all of medicine operates on is, it doesn't matter what doctor you go to, you're going to get the same result at the end of the day, right? Because then if we're not having, that's why we have board certification and recertification and all of these things, we're supposed to be maintaining the quality. And it's that, you know, no matter who you go to, you should be getting something within the confidence interval of a reasonable result. And this is actually not saying that that's entirely not the case, but what it is showing is that in any body of individuals, you're going to have the best performers, and then there's a normal distribution, right? That's like they talk about, like you go into a room and you say, who's a top 10% surgeon in this room? And everybody raises their hands. It's like, well, you can't all be top 10%, right?
Come on.
Yeah. Like, it's not a level hierarchy here. So, you know, on the one hand, to make the conclusion, oh, you should just, like, their conclusion is like taught on day one of any methodology course, like any basic methodology course, you should account for everything that you can possibly account for if you have the power to do it, which of course they do with 5,400 patients. What I was thinking in my head is, wow, you know, this is a finding that really shows that who you see can really drive the outcome. Now, there are outcomes and then there are outcomes. And some of the quality stuff, you know, at the end of the day, a patient stays a little bit longer. Their discharge disposition is different. There's a higher predilection or not in the surgeon's practice for readmission. These don't, you know, there are things that you get maybe flagged for from a quality improvement standpoint, but they don't necessarily mean that the outcome at the end of the day, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, is different. But when you're talking about these scores, then, you know, I don't know. I'm interested in your standpoint.
Well, first of all, as a surgeon, I just want to blame anesthesia for everything.
Right.
So that's the
first
problem.
They put the case on hold.
They did.
They gave the wrong medications, or I don't know. What are you blaming them for? They did the block wrong, or what?
They enabled me to operate. Okay. So your point about individual surgeons is exactly spot on. I was looking for movies where there's like a mole, right? And the Kaiser Sose example to your point is a good one, but there's a bunch of movies who have a little mole in there and it just kind of gets you for it. Because this is talking about surgeon variability as a blanket statement, not surgeon characteristics. Right. What about the age of the surgeon or the experience of the surgeon? Right. Surgeons who have been in practice for a longer period of time are probably likely to keep their patients for longer durations because that's what they're used to. I mean, the length of stay for a total knee used to be 2 weeks. You know, now we're doing same day surgery. Right. But that took decades to go across. Mm-hmm. And people have been in practice that same time. So they're like, oh, to send home a patient the same day might be blasphemy for someone. So is that really a good outcome to your point? They stay a few more days. Hard to say. The other thing, too, is that, you know, if they're in an urban versus suburban environment, I know there's a single institution, but the Cleveland Clinic is a big practice, right? It sprawls over different areas. Are they more urban setting? Are they more suburban setting? What are their expectations for the historical staying at home? So, for example, here, most of my patients get home physical therapy. And that's not something that I traditionally do, but here that's an expectation that patients have when they come into the hospital. So that's another thing that says, and then so the 90-day readmission, they showed it didn't make that much of a difference.
Right.
But it's interesting that they showed, you know, from a predictive value or from a a p-value. Take that with a grain of salt. We'll talk about that in a second. There are relations to the 1 year, you know, Coos Payne, Coos PS, and the Coos Junior. And in those cases, it's only 1 year. I'd like to see longer term frame follow-ups. And the sample size of 5,000, while large, is not that large for the number of surgeons that are in this cohort. So if they expanded this to a bigger cohort, I think that actually be really interesting. But if you look at the Coos Payne, it's, you know, surgeon variable is number 5. You know, it's not 1, 2, 3, and 4. It's number 5. And the same thing is true for Coos PS. It's the 6th most important variable and the 5th most for the Coos Junior. So they're not like the top ones. So it's kind of saying the top, the take-home message, if you just read the abstract, if you just read the title, to your point, is saying, hey, the impact of surgeon variability is huge. But is it that big? You know, you look at all these other patient at variables, right? And we talk about the ADI. And this is one of the studies that looked at ADI. And, you know, patients will come to certain surgeons because they live in that certain region and the surgeon happens to operate in that region. You know, maybe race could be tied into that as well, too. You know, Charleston comorbidity, maybe they're more willing to operate on sicker patients as opposed to their colleagues. So surgeon variability is also a reflection of the surgeons they choose to, the patients they choose to operate on. And that's not really teased out well here, right? How they do is different than necessarily just the surgeon themselves, right? And the last thing I'll say too is like a patient goes to a surgeon for different reasons, right? If they're the best technician possible, to your point, then everyone just go to that one surgeon, right? But they sometimes need a patient who's like, I need handholding. I want someone to walk me through the process and be patient with me. And other people are like, I really just want a technician. I don't want them to talk to me. I want them to cut me, put in a knee, and call it a day. And some people are like, well, I don't want a factory, right? I don't want to have someone who's doing 16 joints a day, but I also don't want someone who's doing one joint a day, you know, or I don't want to drive 20 miles. I only want to drive 2 miles to my surgeon. So there's too many variables that go into this. The question that I have for you as Mr. Methodology is this.
That's my Halloween costume.
It is. Mr. Methods. That's what he's going to call him. So they did this simulation of surgeons treating 30,000 patients by a random sampling of available data, creating a 1 million surgeon-patient combination. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it sounds really great. You know, sounds like, wow, this is, you know, but what you're doing there is really only massaging the margins of the 90. And when you have 5,000 patients already, that's a pretty large number. So when you take that 5,000 and you explode it to 30,000, it is random sampling. And so there are going to be some differences, but it's 5,000 patients nested in 36 surgeons. And so the 36 surgeon variable is probably not going to change that much because it's not like you're creating new avatars of the surgeons. Something else that I think is very important to point out in this regard is just that, you know, this is the Cleveland Clinic. It is an institution that has an outstanding reputation and is known for high clinical productivity and achievement. It's always one of the top rated hospitals. So the 36 individuals who are working there have, just by the fact that they're working there, I'm going to assume, and again, I recognize the bias, but let's just assume, you know, they're the leading edge. They're at the top of their game. And I can say this, you know, as somebody who played high school basketball with 3 NBA players, right? People who are at the top of the game, you know, we in Boston, if you don't win the championship, we're like, that team was terrible. But every one of those guys, from the last on the bench to the starter, could totally destroy you on the court or on the football turf or on the baseball field or on the soccer pitch or on the hockey rink, right? So it's the same kind of thing. Like, it's easy to get, yeah, like the number 36, you got to get rid of him. But there's always going to be a number 36, right? And then what is the real difference? But what's the marginal difference between 36 and number 1? You can't make the guy who's currently, you know, the 13th player on the Celtics, Nick Stauskas, into LeBron James. You can't, right? He's already achieved at a very high level for being the 13th player on the bench for the Boston Celtics. He's not going to become what LeBron James is. So whoever the number 1 is, my hat's off to you, LeBron James of the Cleveland Clinic, but I don't think that the number 36 individual should be feeling bad, really, necessarily in this setting. And I don't think the take-home message should be, well, naturally, we got to stop that 36th guy from operating and all the cases need to go to the number 1 or the number 2 or the number 3. First off, it's not a viable practice model.
And that's the hard part, is it's not going to be like you're going to send every joint to one person in the entire country. So you're welcome, 36, by the way. You're welcome.
So at the end of the day, I would say that the study is very interesting, methodologically sound. I think the conclusion, which for anyone who's done like methods 101 is a bold-faced fact, is on hold. Like, search and variability should be considered when model fitting. That's super profound.
On that note, you want to tell me about some honorable mentions?
Yes. Let's move into the honorable mentions. Cost effectiveness of cement augmentation versus no augmentation for the fixation of unstable trochanteric fractures by Joaris and colleagues. We then have shoulder internal rotation contracture formation in surgically managed C5, C6 brachial plexus birth injuries. Neuropmetic lesions fare worse than avulsions by Ullman and colleagues. This is permanently free. We then have the effects of the TSOL knot on the repair strength and gliding resistance following flexor tendon repair by Berry and colleagues. The systematic isolation of key parameters for estimating skeletal maturity on lateral elbow radiographs by Sinkler and colleagues, and age stratified outcomes of metacasting in idiopathic early onset scoliosis, a multicenter review by Fedorek and colleagues. There's also a comment on that one. That's what's in this issue for November 16th. It's a lot of good stuff. As you can tell, we spent a lot of time on just the three highlight articles, but definitely check it out. Definitely worth your read. I think we're about out of time at this point. So you stay classy, JBJS, and thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
But mostly stay classy.